Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
The True Crime Society podcast contains adult themes and violence and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. And if you'd like to skip the intro or move to any specific part of the podcast, please refer to the timestamps listed in the episode description. Thank you. What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the True Crime Society podcast with Stephanie and Olivia. It is January 30th. We are finally at the end of January 2025.
The 74th tomorrow, day of January.
Yeah, tomorrow is the last day for me. You're on the last day. You're almost out.
We're nearly out. Sad for me, though. Sadder, anyway, because our summer break ends. Kids go back to school. My kids go back on Monday and Tuesday next week. So we're getting to the tail end of summer, which I'm
true. And I guess it's not as traumatic for you with, like, the traumatic election and political world that we're living in right now.
Not
here.
Yet.
Just,
not
like,
yet.
All crazy. So many changes and drama, and the weather's crazy.
It does feel like January has been a big month, even just with world events everywhere. There's a lot going on.
There was the plane crash.
Yeah, that horrible plane crash in Washington, D.C. last night.
A lot of weird stuff going on.
A lot of chaos. That's how – it's just chaotic. I feel like everything's chaotic at the moment.
Yeah, it's not setting up a good intro for 2025.
Maybe, hopefully, this just getting it all out of the way and then it'll be calm the rest of the year.
Yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm. So one more day for me. Hopefully nothing crazy happens tomorrow to end it with a bang, but we'll see.
Yeah.
So we're just going to get right into it. Shocking, I know.
Some people will be happy, though.
Yeah.
non-chat lovers.
We don't have a lot to talk about. We both haven't done anything exciting. And we have an update on Tracy Nix, the episode that just came out last.
So I actually didn't know about this update until someone very helpfully left a comment on our Spotify today saying, have you guys heard about this new development? So we went on, we found the court documents. Basically, Tracy has filed asking for an acquittal or a new trial following her conviction. As Stephanie mentioned, we recently covered her case. And if you're not familiar, I would recommend go back and listen. But basically, just quickly, she's a grandmother. She had 2 grandchildren die separately under her care in 2 separate incidents. One was in 2021 and the other one was in 2022. Tracy went on trial for only one of the deaths, which was the one where her granddaughter Uriel passed away after Tracy left her in a hot car. Tracy had taken the baby out for lunch and then took her home, but apparently just forgot about the baby in the car and went inside to play the piano. Tracy had been facing manslaughter charges as well as a charge of leaving a child in a vehicle for in excess of 15 minutes. Because we've had a lot of – when I posted this on our Instagram today, people are like, what? I thought she was found not guilty. She was acquitted of the manslaughter charge, but she was convicted of the lesser charge. Mm-hmm. She had been facing up to 30 years in prison for manslaughter, but after her conviction, she was probably going to face just a few years. There are varying reports. Some say 60 days, some say 5 years, some say 8 years. Probably would have been a handful of years anyway if she just went along with this conviction. Sentencing was due to happen in April, but her team have filed this document arguing that the conviction should basically be thrown out. The documents talk about how Tracy was taking medication and how they tried to educate the jury on habit memory. So basically that is just where your body, you know, does the same thing day in and day out. And that's kind of why a lot of these incidents happened with Tracy. Maybe she just got out of the car because that was her habit.
It's like autopilot.
Yeah, exactly.
Call it in other cases.
So they said that they tried to tell the jury about that as kind of a aspect of the case, but the court ruled that that evidence would be inadmissible during the trial. The document also states that since the trial, the defense has been contacted by professionals across the country. They list all these professionals like lawyers, you know, psychologists, all these different people, which I don't know why they wouldn't have done this pre-trial, but anyway. And these are the points from those professionals, apparently. It says, in civil law, torts are generally not strict liability offences unless they involve inherently dangerous activities. The second point says, despite the epidemic of car seat deaths across the US, no other state has a statute, criminal or civil, that treats leaving a child alone in a car as a strict liability offence. Then it goes on, the third point, treating mistakenly leaving a car as a strict liability could actually result in more deaths. Children being forgotten in cars did not occur prior to warnings about airbags and child seats in the 1990s, which I feel like that is totally untrue. But anyway, parents and caregivers seeking to avoid being prosecuted for a felony might choose to gamble that they are less likely to be in a car accident than forget their child and place their children in the front passenger seat despite warnings about doing so. So the whole document is on our blog. And the rest of the argument is basically along the lines of, if the jury had been better informed, it would have been likely that Tracy would have been found not guilty on all charges, which I just think this is such a ballsy argument and a ballsy document, because the other argument in this case is that if the jury had have known about the other child's death, which they weren't allowed to discuss in the trial for Uriel, the other child was called Ezra and he drowned in a pond when Tracy was meant to be caring for him and she fell asleep, that was not allowed to be discussed at the trial. So the other argument is if they could have discussed that, I feel like the trial probably also would have had a totally different outcome, not in favor of Tracy at all.
Yeah, I feel like the stuff they're bringing up still doesn't make her not negligent. Like, most people already think, like, yeah, it was an accident, shouldn't do it on purpose, but it still caused the deaths of two little babies.
Yeah, I agree. I just think it's... And for, like, obviously, we were just talking off air. I don't know how long of a sentence she probably would get or will get if they choose to go ahead with it. I would guess maybe 2-3 years max, because she's an elderly woman. Obviously, she was convicted of the lesser charge. She's already served some time. I just feel like that's not a whole lot of time to then put the family through all of this again if they're arguing for a new trial. That's crazy.
Well, and they also try to bring up, like, her medications and the effects of them. But I still feel like it's your responsibility as the person taking the medication to know how it affects you. Especially, it'd be one thing if it was a new medication to her, but it didn't seem like it was, because she said she had been on it for a while and
I'm pretty sure
wasn't so tired
years.
From it.
15 years yeah. was the number that they spoke about in the document. So she had been taking, and it says even when we spoke about the last episode, she knew how this regimen kind of affected her. This was what she did every single night. She took these medications. So, yeah, absolutely not a one-off thing. This happened every night for 15 years, basically.
Yeah, so I just feel like that's still negligent to not take note of, like, oh, this medicine makes me maybe a little more forgetful or just not all there, gives me brain fog. You've been on it long enough to know that, so why is it now suddenly an excuse? Like, it's still negligence, so
yeah.
I don't know. I just think it's a bad look for her. I guess it's probably her... defense and them doing it. I'm sure she doesn't want to go to jail, so but
yeah,
just not a great look for the poor grandma.
I just even for the family, like afterwards we mentioned, so the parents of the, so it was the same parents of both deceased children, Kayla and Drew Schock, and they spoke about basically how they were glad that there was some type of justice, but now for this just going to be ongoing is a nightmare.
Yeah, I'd be so pissed if I was her daughter.
Yeah, me too.
Because now it's just going to drag on longer, where it's like they're still going to have to be dealing with this, whereas before me, they could have started at least healing, maybe a little moving on, being like, it's over.
It's just like it's not. Rubbing salt in the wound almost. You know,
yeah.
just you did the wrong thing. You fucked up. Just accept your sentence for killing your grandchild. It's not like she just, you know.
It's already probably a minimal sentence.
Yeah, it's not something random that she has no, you know, that she didn't know. This is her family and it's just rubbing salt in the wound.
Yeah, so that is that for that case. We'll see what happens, I guess.
Yeah.
Time is precious and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Okay, so today we're going to be talking about a case from Australia, Olivia's homeland. It was actually sent to us by multiple people when there was an episode where we asked for some ideas and suggestions, and I literally opened like 3 messages about this case, people asking us to cover this case back to back, and I was like, geez, I guess we got to cover it. I've never really heard of it, I don't think. You said it was a big case in Australia.
So it is an older case. It happened in 2003, which is sometimes why I'm a little bit hesitant to cover older cases too, because we've mentioned in the past, like, do people already know about all these cases? But maybe you don't know about it. I'm so glad that people recommended or asked us to cover it, because there is so much information out there. It's a really, really, it's an absolutely horrible case, but the investigation was so enormous and massive. Now there's such a repository of information that if you wanted to, you could spend hours and hours and hours learning about Daniel's case. So it was definitely, like, I would say maybe one of the biggest cases ever in Australian history. Definitely in the history of their state it was. But I feel like most Australians who were alive in 2003 would absolutely know about this case.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, like me before doing this episode, Daniel Morcombe, he was 13 years old when he was abducted and murdered in 2003. He lived on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland, Australia.
So I guess the reason too that this case is so widely known in Australia, and just for anyone who isn't really familiar with Australia has a population of around, I think, 26 million people. So the US is approximately 10 times as many people. Things like this don't generally happen in Australia. Obviously they do, but it's very, very rare. So when something like this does happen, it's big news and a big investigation happens. So just to kind of, you know, make you understand why this case in particular stood out in Australian history.
It's been 3 days since 13-year-old Daniel left home for a haircut at Sunshine Plaza. He was last seen on the Nambour Connection Road at a hail and ride bus stop around 2 p.m. on Sunday, standing with an unidentified man. Anyone with information should contact Crime Stoppers on 1-800-333-000.
So again, some background. Daniel was born on December 19th, 1989, to his parents Bruce and Denise. Daniel was also a twin brother. His brother's name was Bradley, and they had another brother who was named Dean. The family lived in Palmwoods, which is a rural town in the Sunshine Coast. As of 2021, the population of the town is 6,357, and the area is known for the pineapple and other fruit that grow there. So if you look at the crime rate info, I mean, pretty much everything is low, like overall low. Vandalism, property crimes, low. Armed robbery, assault, low. Problems with corruption, bribery, low. The only thing that comes up as moderate is people using or dealing drugs.
Yeah, that's pretty standard in most places, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, I have been to the Sunshine Coast many times. I've never been to Palm Woods, but I am familiar-ish with the area. Some of the areas that we'll speak about I'm familiar with. It's a beautiful place. The weather's very mild and moderate, so they don't really get cold winters. They get quite hot summers and mild winters. It's a lovely place. His town sounds quite quiet, like a kind of a sleepy place where you absolutely.
I was gonna say it's more like a suburban versus like city-ish.
Yeah, yeah, it's even more rural. Like, there's obviously a lot of fruit farms and things like that. So it's definitely not like a suburban neighborhood as such. Like, the blocks would be acreages and things like that. So, I'm generalizing because obviously it would kind of change per suburb, but the area was rural, quiet. You know, everyone probably knew everyone, especially in the town where there was only, you know, a few thousand people.
Yeah. So the family owned a Jim's Trees franchise at the time, which is a tree pruning and removal business. Daniel and Bradley, not only were they twin brothers, but they were best friends. Bradley said, Daniel was quiet and shy with people he didn't know, but to his family and friends, he was warm and friendly and fun, just nice to be around. Said he used to pick flowers for mom on the way home from school just because he liked to put a smile on her face. The brothers loved riding their bikes, and they had miniature horses named Sorrento and Bullet. They loved caring for and riding their horses as well. Birthdays and Christmas were always special times for them. Brad said there'd be 2 piles of presents, one for each of us, and we'd take turns to open them. We'd meet at the school bike track after the bell, and we'd ride our bikes home together. We didn't leave each other's side. So Daniel went missing on Sunday, December 7th, 2003, which we believe was summer vacation that time of year, so yeah. There was no school.
I tried to find the dates for school holidays because where I live in a different state to this, and our dates are always a little bit different. I couldn't find the confirmed dates for 2003, but Queensland always go on break a little bit earlier. So I'm pretty sure by that point they would have started their summer break already.
Yeah, it seems like it from other things said throughout the episode, like how they were excited to be off. And
because the next day was Monday and they knew, like he's like, we could have just gone to the shops the next day. Yeah. So yeah. I'm very certain they were off school already for Christmas and summer.
Yeah. So Daniel and Bradley both attended the Siena Catholic College in Sippy Downs, and Daniel had just completed year 9 or 9th grade. That morning, the boys planned to pick passion fruit at their neighbor's property, which they were doing to save money. And it was a rainy day, so they had to start a little later than they planned, but then they were driven home by their neighbor at 9:45. So it seems like they were kind of doing like a little job and they'd get paid for it. When they got home, their parents, Bruce and Denise, were about to leave for their work Christmas party, which was from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. The boys were asked if they wanted to go, but of course they said no, because who would want to go to their parents' work Christmas party?
Yeah.
Brad said, we were happy to do our own thing. He said Dean and Daniel spent the morning wrestling in Mom and Dad's room, and then Daniel decided to go shopping. He tried to get us to go with him to Sunshine Plaza, the local shopping center in
Maroochydore.
Dean was going to ride his bike to a friend's house, and I remember that Daniel begged me to go with him, but I wanted to go the next day, on the Monday. I don't really know why. I was just happy to be home that day. Daniel showered and put on a red Billabong t-shirt. He wanted to get a haircut and buy Christmas presents for his family with the $150 that he had saved from fruit picking. Brad said, I was at the computer when he left. I heard him say goodbye over my shoulder, but I didn't turn around. I didn't really look at him as he said goodbye. He just walked out off on his own.
The what-ifs for these brothers are just as painful as they are for Denise and Bruce. Daniel wanted them to go shopping with him that day, but both turned him down.
Daniel asked me a few times if I want to go to the shops. I said, no, I don't want to go. I want to see my mates. He asked me again. Oh, I don't want to go.
I don't know why I didn't go by with him, so he went off by himself, and then a few hours passed and basically he didn't catch the bus home, so...
Do you have a sense of guilt about that?
No, not entirely. Not entirely.
That means a little bit.
Oh, well, you know, but you can't blame yourself.
No, you can't.
How would you describe the emotions you feel?
There is times... When you're angry, there's times, yeah, you just...
Why did that have to happen to him?
Daniel left the home around 1 p.m. and walked for about 20 minutes to the bus stop at Keel Mountain Road overpass and waited for the bus. His parents said he'd walked to catch the bus many times before. I can't decide if, like, ninth grade, like, did he tell his parents he was going to go to the shops? In ninth grade, I feel like I would be allowed to, like, walk home from school, but, like, my mom knew I was out of school, and that me and my I didn't walk alone. It would be, like, me and my friend would, and I lived close to the school, like, very close. Yeah. We'd walk to the little deli that was across the street from the school, get a sandwich, eat the sandwiches, and then we'd, like, walk home. And it was very close. Mm. But I don't know if, because I don't live in an area where it would be normal to, like, get on a bus and take a bus. My parents would always drive us everywhere.
Yeah.
I don't think my parents would ever let me just, like, hop on a bus and go to a shopping center by myself in ninth grade, but it seemed more common there. I mean, they said he'd done it before, so.
I feel like it is a little bit different here. Like, most of the kids I know, because where I live, we have no trains. We only have buses. Or, like, no trains in the kind of suburbs. We only have buses. So, like, a lot of the kids here who are that age do catch buses. Like, I feel like it's pretty normal behavior for the time in the area.
Yeah. I've never taken a public transport bus in my life. So the bus approached and Daniel tried to flag it down, but the driver didn't stop. The bus driver was a man named Ross Edmonds, who later said that his bus had broken down the afternoon, so he was running late for his route. He said a supervisor told him to go directly to Maroochydore and another bus would handle the pickups. So a second bus was organized to pick up passengers so that Ross could get back on schedule. Ross spoke about seeing Daniel try to flag the bus down. He said, "He lifted his finger and I pointed at him to indicate that there was another bus coming," which I don't think would tell me there was another bus coming. I'd be like, "Why are you pointing at me? Why are you stopping?"
I guess it was
bus?
More so like an acknowledgement, like, "Yep, I see," like, and I understand like, what he was trying coming. To convey. Like, "I yeah. see you, like, I see you, just wait 2 seconds, there'll be another bus coming." But yeah, I obviously would Daniel have understood
I'd
that?
Be so
I don't
confused.
Know. Yeah.
So Ross then used the bus radio to tell the other driver that someone was waiting under the overpass, and he continued on his route. And the second bus showed up within 2 minutes of the first, but by that time there was nobody waiting, which is yeah. very quick for him to be gone.
Some other reports even say like 30 seconds, and I thought there's no way it could have happened in, like, I guess maybe it could have happened in 30 seconds, but I feel like it was likely at least a minute or two. It was still a very quick time frame, but yeah, very
yeah.
crazy that he was able to be abducted in that very short time period.
Yeah. So a local resident named Belinda Russell was in the area at the time, and she said she saw a fairly young-looking boy with black hair wearing a red T-shirt and fairly white shoes in the shadow of the Keel Mountain Road overpass around 12:30, 1 o'clock. She saw the bus drive past him. Other witnesses reported seeing a scruffy-looking man standing near him at the time. Belinda said shortly after that, she saw a sky blue, sun-faded four-door sedan. The vehicle pulled sharply in front of her and was moving around violently. She said, "I could see a person, which I thought was a male, in the back seat. He was punching and moving violently in the back seat, slightly to the right." She was concerned that someone in the car was being beat up, and she even tried to write down the car registration on a shopping list that she had with her, but of course, the pen didn't work. So then around 4 p.m., Daniel's parents returned home from the party they were at. And on Sundays, the buses ran hourly, so Denise, the mother, drove to the bus stop to pick up Daniel to see if he would be on the 4:30 bus, but he wasn't. So she went back home, and then Bruce, the father, returned at 5:30 to be like, well, he must be on that bus because that was the last bus for the day, but he wasn't on that one either. So the parents then decided to go to the shopping center and look around for him themselves, since it seems like he didn't catch a bus back.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
When they couldn't find him at the shopping center, they drove the bus route home to look for him to see if maybe he got off somewhere else or was walking. They tried to call the bus company to see if Daniel had been on any bus, but of course, since it was Sunday afternoon, no one was working. They ended up intercepting a bus and asked the driver, and the driver just confirmed that there was really nobody who would be able to confirm if Daniel was on the bus or not.
And I guess, too, this is also prior to a lot of CCTV. Like 2003, it was probably just emerging then, but, you know, like now most buses would have cameras and things like that. Back then, that would probably not have been so much of a thing.
So the Morecambes then went back to the Sunshine Plaza to look around again. And by 7:30 that night, they tried to report him missing to the police. The police asked about any mental health issues, and his parents said that the disappearance was totally out of character. But police advised Daniel's parents to return home and said that it was likely that there was just a misunderstanding, which is infuriating.
Yeah.
Police said that Daniel was likely with his friends or just running late to get home. Bruce and Denise were told that Daniel would not be listed as a missing person at that stage. Bruce and Denise then went home and they contacted some of Daniel's friends, but nobody had seen or heard from him. And using a torch, which I'm assuming is a flashlight.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I didn't even think about that. Yeah, a torch is a flashlight.
To me, when you say like using a torch, I think of like a flame.
Like a survivor torch.
Like a stick with a flame.
No. Yeah, like people would know what a flashlight is, but everyone calls them a torch.
Yeah. Using a torch, they returned to the bus stop to search around the area again. Police called Bruce and Denise 3 times that night to see if Daniel had returned home. and the last call was made to them at 11 p.m., and they were advised to make a missing person report the following morning when the police station opened at 8 a.m. I'd be like, bitch, make one now. What do you mean?
I know. I think this goes back to energy. It goes back to things like this don't really happen. There's probably an explanation for this, you know, which is why it took them a while, which I absolutely agree was the wrong way to do it, but I do understand why it kind of happened back then.
It's like, damn, like you guys could like drive around or something. Come on. So according to the future coronial inquest, Daniel's disappearance was not taken seriously, as it was very unusual for a child to vanish in the state. As Olivia was just saying, since 1972, there had only been 4 other cases involving missing children, which is crazy. I feel like that happens in like a day here.
I think, I should have probably clarified, 4 missing children that have never been found. So, yeah.
But still a very low number regardless.
Yeah.
So at first light the next day, Bruce and Denise began searching again. And when the police station opened at 8 a.m., they were finally able to make a missing person report. That's like, you have to wait till it opens, not 7 a.m.,
yeah.
8 a.m.
Yeah.
When we open.
That's crazy, because our local police station too is an unmanned police station, which is not very helpful. So like, if you ever needed anything, you can't go there. You have to go to somewhere else because they only manned it, you know, whenever they feel like going there.
I've never really thought of that, but I just assume like someone would always be there to answer the phone at least, yeah. Like dispatch.
I guess
like,
they've got a non-emergency. Like, obviously, you'd call. Well, here it's 000 is our 911. But obviously, and they do have a non-emergency line where you can call if there's something that you need help with, but it's not life or death. So I'm assuming that just goes to a central police station somewhere. But yeah, I'm just like, what's the point if you actually need to go speak to someone to have no one to
just
speak
for
to?
Show?
Yeah.
So a major incident room was established at Maroochydore Police Station on December 9th, and the investigation involved over 100 police officers. On December 14th, 2003, a reenactment of the day was carried out at the overpass. I think this is like very interesting because I'm like, why would these things help? But it seems like it did generate tips eventually. But so a mannequin wearing clothing identical to what Daniel had been wearing was placed at the overpass. That's what I'm like, what is that going
to
do?
I feel like it's meant to jog people's memories. So if you had been kind of driving past at the time, you'd be like, oh yeah, I did see that boy there. And I saw someone else there. Or it's just kind of, you know, because you might think, and they have done this quite a few times. Like I'm sure they did it in the Peter Falconio case, which we've spoken about before as well.
It seems silly, but it must work if they do it.
Just to kind of, but the other thing, I don't know, then it goes into the other discussion. Could maybe people then create memories that didn't quite exist at the time, I don't know. But yeah, an interesting strategy, I agree.
So during the course of the investigation, over 10,000 people were interviewed and over 22,000 job logs were created. Each job log represented a piece of information or physical evidence. Police reviewed over 200 hours of CCTV. They door knocked on almost 900 homes in the area. This was the largest operation ever undertaken by police. Sounds very massive. The police report would end up being over 10,000 pages long. Brad, his brother, spoke about the aftermath of Daniel's disappearance. He said it was incredibly difficult and that his mother was crushed and distraught. He said, Dad was a bit stronger, trying to hold the family together. Dean was at work a lot of the time, trying to carry on. And I was at home by myself with Mom and Dad for the rest of the school holidays. So Brad went back to school 6 weeks after Daniel's disappearance, and he said, that was a hard day. Normally, we'd have gone together on the bus, but Mom and Dad took me in the car. I remember walking in through the gates at school knowing Daniel wasn't beside me. According to the coroner, the investigation into Daniel's case was the largest criminal investigation in Queensland history.
Yeah, as we mentioned, they did things like carry out the reenactment of Daniel at the bus stop. When they eventually had some suspects, they also did reenactments of that at the bus stop, like placed mannequins in cars and things like that, similar to what had possibly been seen in the hope that someone's memory would be jogged. After they carried out things like that, they got more than 300 tips. So as we mentioned, it is clearly a somewhat effective means of investigation. But kind of interesting tactics were used.
I guess it's true because if I think about it, if anyone asked if I saw someone like walking on my way home from work or something, I don't think I would just randomly think of it. But then there's like random people that you see multiple times. So even if it was a mannequin, you'd be like, oh yeah, that's that person that I saw the other day. So it makes sense. So Brad said, our greatest hope in those early days was that there would be a quick and happy outcome. We hoped that he would just one day walk through the front door unexpectedly. We hoped he'd just arrive out of the blue and walk in the front door. But as time passed, that became less and less likely. And finally, about a year after, we began to accept that it probably wouldn't happen like that. Denise kept Daniel's room exactly as he had left it for years after he disappeared. She even kept some pajamas folded on his bed, ready for when he came back. Brad said, Mom kept the door closed a lot of the time, especially as time went on. It was hard to look in there. Sometimes I'd go in there and think about us and where he might be, about what was happening. I felt a little closer to him.
I as a family, this would be one of the hardest things that you could ever endure. But then as a twin, I just can't even imagine the extra, you know, heartache and just, you know, basically you've lost a piece of yourself pretty much.
Yeah, being a 13-year-old boy. Always together.
And even the survivor's guilt, I imagine that he had, which obviously he shouldn't.
Because you want him to go.
Yeah. And like he survived, he didn't go. Brad would have had so much to deal with over these years after this.
Yeah. So Denise finally packed his room away in 2006. She said, I put his clothes and things into boxes and stored them away. That was one of the hardest things I've ever done. When we moved houses, I brought the boxes with us. By December 2008, the government had offered a reward of $250,000 for information in the case. Over $750,000 had also been donated privately.
So it's a reward of $1 million, which in 2008 was a lot of money. So like it's a massive amount of money for a reward in a child
abduction
case.
You don't see really rewards like that nowadays.
No. Occasionally the government here will do a really, really large reward. Like I think that for William Tyrrell it might be $1 million, like, but very rarely they'll do it. It's just for really kind of high profile or really cold cases where they are desperate for some information.
And side note, I feel like you never hear about people actually getting the rewards.
Yeah, I know. There's always a loophole where they're like, nope, you just.
I'd be curious if anybody knows someone who actually got a reward.
Well, it's like,
remember with more about that.
Luigi Mangione, where the McDonald's worker called it in and there was some reason why he wasn't probably going to get the reward. I don't know. But.
Yeah, there's always like some loophole or like weird thing. I don't know. I'd be interested to learn more about how all that works.
So in July 2009, which was almost 6 years after Daniel disappeared, his parents asked for a coronial inquest into his disappearance. We have spoken about them in some Australian episodes in the past, but if you're not familiar with what a coronial inquest is, it's basically a court hearing which is conducted by a coroner to gather information about the cause and circumstances of a death. An inquest isn't a trial, so it's not like a criminal trial. There's no jury. It's not about deciding whether a person is guilty of an offence or civilly liable. So in every state in Australia, there is a coroner's court. I find a lot of the time the process is a bit ridiculous because a lot of the times the findings are kind of undetermined. We can't make a determination, especially in missing persons cases, which is what this was at the time. The thing that I guess is beneficial for a coroner is that they are more freely able to question people who they believe may be involved in the case, and what actually happens in the coroner's court won't lead to the person being charged as such, but it may lead to further police investigation.
This I wish is we had something like that, but
yeah,
I feel like we have too much crime here to ever actually get it
I
done.
I guess for you, maybe it's a little bit like a grand jury. Like, I don't know.
True.
I know, like it's obviously not the same because there's no jury in a coroner's inquest, but like, you know, it's kind of something that may eventually lead to charges, but nothing actually will happen directly in the coroner's court. This is just a little bit more of information about it. It says, you cannot be directly arrested after a coronial inquest solely based on coroner's findings. If the coroner believes a person may have committed a crime, they can refer the matter to the Director of Public Prosecutions, who can then decide to press charges and initiate arrest if warranted. The coroner cannot find someone guilty, but they can flag potential criminal activity. And then it says basically the coroner has no direct arrest power, and that if something does come out of a coronial inquest, it would then have to be decided if a criminal trial would happen. So Daniel's parents said they requested the inquest as they thought it was time to, quote, apply the legal blowtorch to some persons of interest in the case. So this is 6 years after he disappeared. There were multiple people of interest. Bruce said that recent publicity in the case at the time had outed several key persons of interest. He said, most of that information is not new to us or new to the police. We've been able to keep those lines of inquiry out of the public arena, which police say is always helpful to the investigation. Now that they're in the public arena, it's time for the state coroner to apply the due legal process to work through Daniel's police case file and see what he can make of those persons of interest. Bruce said that he hoped the coroner's ability to speak to key people at the pointy end of the investigation, which was his wording, under oath, would lead to some movement in the case. So they requested the inquest in 2009. It started on 11th of October 2010. In August of 2011, the inquest was adjourned. For a case of this size, the inquest was a really long, drawn-out process. Despite the inquest running for 10 months, there had been 23 hearing days during that time. Evidence had been taken from 60 witnesses, including police officers and persons of interest, and 760 exhibits were presented during the inquest. By the time the inquest started, the police had identified 35 persons of interest, which is such a wild amount to even begin to whittle down. 35, yeah. Like, a person of interest is someone who has a, you know, a relative probability that they could be involved in the case. 35 of them is a lot. So the coroner heard the evidence from investigators regarding the persons of interest. It was then ruled that six of those 35 should be called to give evidence at the inquest.
I feel like one, six is still like a lot to be taking seriously.
Absolutely. One of the people called was a man named Brett Peter Cowan. So Brett was born on the 18th of September 1969, which would have made him 34 at the time that Daniel disappeared. And he was a local of this resident. He was a local resident at the time that Daniel disappeared of the Sunshine Coast. He had a very lengthy criminal history. He first started offending apparently when he was a child, aged around 9 or 10. His first conviction came in 1989, though, so he would have been around 19 or 20, after he molested a seven-year-old boy in the public toilet of a playground, and he was sentenced to 2 years for indecent dealing. 4 years after that, he moved to the Northern Territory, which is another state. He was living in Darwin, and he was living in a caravan park, which is like a trailer park. He molested a six-year-old boy in a violent attack. The child was left with a punctured lung. Brett left the child to die in an old car in the bush. The child managed to escape and walk naked and bleeding to a service station, which is a gas station, for help. The child's eyes had hemorrhaged from strangulation, and police initially thought, because of his injuries, that he'd been run over by a car. So this poor six-year-old boy.
Poor thing.
Oh, absolutely horrific and so graphic and violent. Just obviously this gives you an idea of what type of man this is.
Mm.
Brett denied any involvement in that attack until police said they had DNA evidence that linked him to it. So he pled guilty in September 1993 to gross indecency, grievous bodily harm, and deprivation of liberty, and he was sentenced to 7 years in jail, which I think that is such a minimal sentence.
It's like nothing.
It's absolutely disgusting, that sentence, for what he did to that child.
What the hell?
Brett was released on parole in 1998, and he moved to the Sunshine Coast. He apparently became a kind of a changed man. He joined a church called the Christian Outreach Church. He met a woman named Tracy Moncrief through the church. They got married in 1999 and had a child together. The couple were living in Beerwah in 2003 when Daniel went missing, which was part of the Sunshine Coast. They divorced in 2004. Brett was a suspect very early on in Daniel's case. He was first interviewed by police 2 weeks after Daniel vanished. So he was kind of on their radar because he was a known sex offender to young boys. He had this background. He was on the radar very early. But it just took a very long time for anything to come to fruition, I guess. After Daniel disappeared, Brett changed his name to Shadow Nanya Hunter, which is on brand, I guess. When Brett appeared in front of the coroner, he said, "I had nothing to do with Daniel's disappearance, nothing at all." By the time of the coronial inquest, he'd moved interstate again, and he told the court that by that point he had three of his own children. Brett's alibi for the time that Daniel disappeared was that he had visited the home of a woman named Sandra Drummond to, quote, buy pot. He said, "I always spend a minimum of half an hour at Sandy's place." Brett said that he thought, quote, "It was funny that they still thought I had something to do with Daniel's disappearance over 30 minutes or 35 minutes, whatever it was, just having like to do something in half an hour or get rid of or, you know, anything like that. I don't think it's possible." So basically he said at the time he was buying pot at this woman's house, he was there for a longer time and that basically he wouldn't have had enough time to get rid of Daniel because he was buying marijuana.
Of course, of course.
Police conducted what's called a Mr. Big operation in relation to Brett and his involvement in Daniel's case. If you're not sure what that is.
I love the scheming.
Yeah, it was very clever, very tactical and very covert, and it took them a long time to get
very
to this
involved
point. Yeah. So if you're not sure what a Mr. Big investigation is, it's also known as the Canadian technique. It says it's a covert investigation procedure used by undercover police to elicit confessions from suspects in cold cases, usually murder. It says police officers create a fictitious grey area or criminal organisation, and then they then seduce the suspect into joining it. They build a relationship with the suspect, gain their confidence, and then enlist their help in a succession of criminal acts such as delivering goods, credit card scams, kind of minor petty crimes for which they are paid. Once the suspect has become enmeshed in the criminal gang, they are persuaded to divulge information about their own criminal history, usually as a prerequisite for being accepted as a member of the organization. So basically they trap him in and say, giving him these minor jobs, and then they say, we've got a bigger job for you. Yeah, fake gang. We've got a bigger job for you, but you need to be honest with us because we need to know what we're dealing with. And that by that point, there's some trust, so the person confesses, essentially.
They must have been pretty confident it was him to go through all this effort.
So Queensland detectives disguise themselves as loan sharks and brothel madams. They managed to convince Brett that they were all members of the same criminal gang. They invited him in 2011 to join their fake gang, and he was paid to stand over prostitutes and sex workers, and he was made to pay fake bribes to customs officers. This went on for months, and then he was invited to take part in a bigger operation that they said to him was worth $100,000. They told Brett that they were worried because police had been watching him as he was a suspect in Daniel's case. The gang members, promised to buy Brett an alibi and help him clean up the crime scene. They also said they would do this so that other gang members would not feel the heat from having him around. So that was enough for Brett. Brett then confessed to Daniel's murder. He said that he had snapped Daniel's neck after he had abducted him from the bus stop. He said that he had stopped and offered to drive him to the shopping center, and that's how he got Daniel in the car. So he was driving around, saw Daniel waiting for the bus, took it the opportunity and said, hey, the bus drove past, I'll give you a lift, and Daniel got in the car. Brett said that he only wanted to molest Daniel and that he had not planned to murder him. He drove Daniel to a macadamia farm in a secluded area. He told Daniel that they were going there so that Brett could tell his wife where they were going. So along the lines of, hey, I've just got to drop home and tell my wife I'm going to drop you to the shops. And that's how he got Daniel to this secluded area. Mm. He said he offered Daniel a drink and then tried to pull his pants down. And Brett said that he panicked when Daniel tried to flee. He dragged Daniel's body into an old sand mine into the bush and covered it up with branches and leaves. And this is a quote from his alleged confession. There are clips of it online. Maybe we'll put a clip in here, and there's clips on the blog. But he said, and that's where it happened. That's where I thought he was going to run, and my arm went around his neck and I choked him out. I actually felt that break in there, which is absolutely horrible. So after this confession, Brett was charged with Daniel's murder in August 2011, and that is why the coronial inquest was adjourned at that point. Along with the murder charge, he was also charged with child stealing, deprivation of liberty, indecent treatment of a child under 16, and interfering with a corpse. So detectives used his confession to figure out the area where Daniel's remains had been dumped. And on the 21st of August 2011, they found two shoes and three human bones at a site in the Glasshouse Mountains. For anyone who's not familiar with the area, very, very bushy, very rural, very, very secluded. Like, the Glasshouse Mountains are it's a very large area. I totally understand why they couldn't have found the remains without him actually giving some information as to where they were. Mm. The shoes that they found were similar to the ones that Daniel had been wearing on the day that he disappeared. They also found underpants and a belt. Police would end up finding 17 bones, including a rib, hip, leg, arm, and vertebrae. So this is 9 years after Daniel disappeared, basically.
Crazy.
By that point, I guess things had been scavenged by animals and, you know, the elements and things like that. So that was all they were able to find.
Bad weather is hindering the search for the remains of Daniel Morecambe after the discovery of three human bones over the weekend. Two matching shoes were earlier found in the search area. Daniel Morecambe went missing nearly 8 years ago as he waited for a bus on the Sunshine Coast. Reporter Lauren Day is at the search site.
Well, the Morecambe's lawyer, Peter Boyce, says police and SES will be buoyed by this latest find. The three bones were found close to where a pair of missing shoes were also located, in the primary search zone, which is a small area of only around 12 by 6 metres. So it's given them some idea that they're in the right place at least.
Forensic tests have been carried out on the bones and on the shoes. Do we know how long they will take?
The forensic testing should take a number of weeks, but initial tests have confirmed that these bones are human. Police continue to search here, and it's painstaking work. We've seen them on their hands and knees, and some are up to their armpits in mud. So this rain won't be making it any easier.
And what's been the response of Daniel Morecambe's family to these latest discoveries?
Well, the Morecambes were notified yesterday. They were at a family function interstate, but Bruce Morecambe is believed to be returning to Queensland today, and he'll speak with the media shortly. Their lawyer, Peter Boyce, says that while they were hoping for this news, it's also a very difficult time for them. And Bruce Morecambe said last week that with every new piece of information, it's shocking for the family.
Lauren, thank you.
Thank you.
Police used DNA from Daniel's toothbrush to confirm that the remains belonged to him. So they did adjourn, as I mentioned, they did adjourn the coronial inquest after Brett's arrest, and that was so the legal process could then take place, because that was not able to happen during the inquest process. Daniel's family held a funeral for him in December 2012, and more than 2,000 people attended. So when you think about that, that's more than a third of the whole area attended. It's crazy. Brett's trial ended up beginning on 10th of February 2014, and it ran until the 7th of March that year. 116 witnesses gave evidence, and over 200 exhibits were presented. Brett pled not guilty, and he declined to give evidence at the trial. His defense argued, though, that he'd made up this confession because he just really wanted to be part of this criminal gang. So he kind of said it to be cool and get in the gang.
But it's like, what gang is going to be okay with a guy who molests little boys? I feel like that's not very gang, but I don't know. I wouldn't know what gangs are okay with and not, but.
His barrister, Angus Edwards, tried to argue that there was another convicted child sex offender named Douglas Jackway, and he was the one responsible for Daniel's death. They said that Douglas may have told other criminals where he'd put Daniel's body, and then those criminals gave the details to Brett. So basically Brett knew where the, because like it's very convenient if he made up the confession that he knew where the remains were, but he did that because he'd been told secondhand that someone else had killed Daniel and this is where the body was.
Yeah.
On the 13th of March 2014, Brett was found guilty on all charges. He was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 20 years. He was also sentenced to 3.5 years imprisonment for indecently dealing with Daniel and 2 years for interfering with his corpse. And those sentences were to be served concurrently. The judge, Roslyn Atkinson, said, "I don't think you should be released in 20 years' time."
No.
Brett appealed the sentence. His legal team argued that his confession was elicited through an undercover sting by police and therefore it should be inadmissible as evidence at trial. His appeal was dismissed in 2015. The former Queensland Attorney General also appealed to have Brett's sentence increased, and this was dismissed. I think it's very, very unlikely that he will get out in 20 years. That was the sentence imposed because basically it had to be imposed. I feel like for such a high-profile case, for someone who has such a disgusting, repulsive criminal past, there is no way he will be getting out in 20 years.
He should be in there for life.
Yeah. So after Brett's methods of appeal were exhausted, the coronial inquest resumed in 2016. The family wanted answers at this point as to why Brett kind of wasn't convicted earlier, why his alibi wasn't questioned more. The entire document is 71 pages. I've linked it on our blog if you want to read it. It's obviously a horrible and sad read, but it's very interesting if you want to learn more about the investigation, how they kind of narrowed down suspects, why the investigation ran like it did. And it's interesting to read now because the investigation has concluded. So it's a very thorough and comprehensive summary of the case. It goes into a lot of detail with witness statements and about why they focused on Brett Peter Cowan as well. So I highly recommend checking it out. One, I guess, positive that came from Daniel's death is that after the inquest, Sunbus, who was the bus company that failed to pick him up, said that they've now implemented a policy that a driver must now always pick up a child, even if the child does not have the fare to pay. And I was actually talking about this case with friends last night, and apparently that's an Australia-wide rule, which I haven't confirmed yet. But they said basically if a child tries to get on a bus, the bus driver has to let them on, even if they don't have their fare card or the fare to pay, the child is always allowed to get on the bus.
Yeah, it seems like a good rule law to have. I wonder if the bus driver like feels guilty. Obviously,
yeah, I have seen him in some interviews
where he feels like shit.
I have seen him in some interviews where he's broken down. Like, obviously, he was just doing his job. You would never think that with the bus coming, you know, even two minutes later.
Right behind.
Anything. Yeah. Yeah, it's very sad. He would also, I'm
it
sure.
It really was like all the stars aligned in a bad way. Like, where are the chances? The bus was running late. He wasn't picking up. And then that guy's car must have been just like, what, right behind the bus, basically, but right before the other bus?
Yeah.
It's crazy how it all worked out.
So if Daniel was alive today, he would be 35 years old. Since his murder, his family have established the Daniel Morcombe Foundation. This is their mission statement. It says, today we build a future where children are safe from harm and abuse and can have the opportunity to thrive. We would like to see a future where all children and young people are provided with education, protection, and support to be safe from abuse and risk of harm. Daniel Morcombe Foundation provides personal child safety education to children and young people to prevent abuse and to promote lifelong health and well-being. We support educators, parents, and carers through the provision of resources and education, and also directly support young victims of crime. Every year, still to this day, the foundation also holds what they call a Day for Daniel, which is held on October. It's held on the last Friday of October. This year, it's Friday 31st of October. It says, basically, they honour the memory of Daniel. We ask all Australians on this very special day to wear red, educate and donate. It's Australia's largest child safety education and awareness day. So I know a lot of schools take part in this, like because here pretty much every school has a uniform. So a lot of on that day, a lot of schools will allow the kids to wear red in honour of Daniel.
That's nice.
This year, so despite this case now happening over 21 years ago, that Daniel and his family are still in the media. There's still things happening. This year, the Queensland government is set to introduce Daniel's law. It means that there will be a publicly accessible sex offender registry, which I can't believe it doesn't exist already in Australia. But
yeah,
anyway,
what?
Yeah, that is happening here. It would allow parents to search the names and photos of the offenders. Bruce said, a public sex offender register is not a silver bullet because if you haven't been caught, you won't be on the register. But that doesn't mean it's not a great step in the right direction. We think it's important in keeping Queenslanders safe. It will be important in the domino effect to get all of Australia up and running with the Daniel's Law. Under the law, the register would have three tiers, including a public website with names and photos of offenders who breach reporting obligations. The public would also be able to apply to find out which high-risk offenders live in their area. And under the third tier, parents and guardians would be able to inquire about adults who have unsupervised time with their children. Bruce said, to ordinary mums and dads out there, please don't fall into the trap of thinking this won't happen to me. A publicly accessible sex offender registry will be helpful, but at the end of the day, you must look after your kids and make sure that you're one step ahead of who they are chatting to online. So Bruce and Denise have been very vocal in the media since Daniel's abduction and murder. They've done a lot of child safety protection. You know, they've implemented a lot of different things, and that's part of what Daniel's law is going to bring into play. So even though, obviously, this would be the hardest thing that their family went through, the family has had some joy in recent years. Both of the sons have now had their own children. Brad, Daniel's twin, and his wife, Alice, had a son in 2016, and they named him Winston Daniel George Morcombe. Denise said, he's simply the most gorgeous little boy, isn't he? He's such a perfect little man. Holding him like this reminds me so much of when our twin boys, Daniel and Brad, were born. There's always so much hope and promise around the birth of a baby. Dean and his wife Alice had their first daughter in 2021. Her name was Elsie, and their second child, Iris, was born in 2023. So Denise and Bruce are now grandparents. They're just such lovely people. Any interview I see with them, they just seem so kind, so caring, so family-oriented, and they've really tried to find some way to make something good out of the case.
Yeah.
Brad has spoken about the regret he has because when he didn't go to the bus stop with Daniel that day, he said, it's not easy, but I didn't know what was going to happen. You can't change what happened. I wish I did go with him, though I wasn't to know. He said, I've thought about it a lot. It could easily have been me walking out the door and not Daniel. I've stood at the same bus stop by myself on a trip into town many times, and I wonder what might have happened if I'd gone with him. Perhaps it would have been both of us that disappeared. But I think that whoever came along probably wouldn't have tried if there were two people. If I'd gone with him, it's more than likely he'd still be here. He went on to say, he is with us all the time, every single day. He's still part of the family. He'll always be my brother, and I'll always miss him, no matter what happens in the future.
Sad.
So, yeah, just a horrible, sad case. It's just one of those ones where your life can change in literally a minute or a second based on one decision, one innocent decision, when it just takes one horrible, awful person to change the lives of so many for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, it just kind of goes back to what I was saying before of just how everything aligns so perfectly for something terrible to happen. And one of those things was also like his brother just didn't feel like going with him, because I bet the guy wouldn't have stopped if they were together.
Especially because two boys would be much harder to control. Like, it doesn't sound like there was a gun. He literally said that he choked him. So, yeah, I feel like absolutely, and obviously you can't change what happened, but it would have been probably, I agree, a different story if they both went.
Yeah. I was just looking at the, because you were talking about the sex offender registry. I was just looking at the map. There's one that lives kind of close to me. That's what's crazy. You guys can't, like, look that up?
No. And I feel like, no. Not that I know of. Like, so here, I don't know if it's the same there, but, and it might maybe different state by state, but in my state, to have access to children, like, for example, when I go volunteer at my kids' school, or when you volunteer at kids' sports, every person who is working kind of in a volunteer or an official capacity with children needs to have a working with children check. So that goes through, basically you have to submit to that. And then if you are clear and you have no offenses, you are given, like, your clearance check. So that is one thing that they do here that kind of protects children, I guess, a little bit. But like what Bruce said, if no one's been caught, nothing's going to show up. But yeah, no, as far as I know, there is no other way to look at sex offenders. Legal records here are very closed. It's very, very hard to get information until there's a conviction, which can take years. And even then, a lot of the time names are redacted if there's minors involved. So yeah. We definitely don't have an open system yet here.
Well, it's good that hopefully your one's coming.
Yes, fingers crossed. And I said that's happening this year, so obviously we're quite early in the year, but I would hope too that it's going to be rolled out to all states, not just Queensland. It would be a very helpful tool.
Man, it's crazy. Like, when you zoom out on the map, like, you put in your address and it'll bring up a map of all the offenders. It's actually crazy how many just kind of live in the area and you don't even really know it.
I know. Even when you just think, when you're walking down the street, you know, imagine all these people who have all these things going on that you have no idea about. So if you are in Australia, there is a ton of media about Daniel's case. There's some 60 Minutes. I think it's a two-part 60 Minutes where they basically document how they found Brett Peter Cowan, the investigation. There's so many videos. I've put some of them on the blog. We'll put some clips in this episode too, but yeah, there's a lot of information, and I really recommend reading the coroner's inquest if you'd like to learn more in real detail about the investigation.
All right, so that is it for this episode. Everything will be on the blog at truecrimesocietyblog.com. If you want to read more about it, or the documents that Olivia was talking about are linked on there as well if you want to read that really comprehensive write-up. Maybe I'll read that tonight as a bedtime reading. Make sure you're following us on Instagram. We're always posting updates on cases there as well at True Crime Society. And if you want to follow our personal pages, mine is StephSum_, Olivia's TCS Olivia, if you want to see what we're up to. Make sure you check us out on Patreon if you're interested in more content from us. We do weekly bonus episodes. We also do all the episodes ad-free. And we do earlier release on these main episodes. We put them out like a day earlier. So check us out over there. And otherwise, just all the usual stuff. You could share the podcast, share to your Instagram stories, leave us any comments on Spotify and nice reviews. All those things are very helpful to us when you do them. So we greatly appreciate it. And that's it. So thank you guys for listening. As always, stay safe out there. Peace out.
See ya.